Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now entering the Second People Comics podcast, starring Mark Clare and Rimzo Martinez.
The time has finally come, ladies and gentlemen. The time that you have all been waiting for, we have all been waiting for, but we are finally going to tackle a story that I don't want to say we've been avoiding it, but we might have been putting it off a little bit, not because it's bad, just because it's huge and epic and takes a lot of work. But we are finally going to be looking this week, starting this week, I should say, over the course of the next 3 weeks, at the epic DC crossover known as Crisis on Infinite Earths. I could literally not do this alone, so of course I have, as always, my partner in comic book crime, the rambunctious one himself, Rimzo Martinez. What's up, man?
He's here. The Anti-Monitor is here with 12 issues that change the comic book world forever. You'd think that Secret Wars could do it. You'd think that all these other things could do it. Everything comes back to the King Daddy Mamma Jamma moment itself with the 12 issues of Crisis on Infinite Earths. Worlds will collide. Characters and heroes you love will fall. New opportunities, journeys, and adventures await all your favorite DC heroes in the event which crossed over them all. Mark, I have been avoiding this story. I've begged you, I've pleaded, I've gotten on my knees and groveled.
I've been pushing it for like a year. Like, when are we going to do Crisis? When are we going to do it? Come on.
I want to go ahead and just give people some behind the scenes look. This was going to be the big first crossover event. We've covered little things before. We've covered some mini series here and there, but like we were talking like, oh, one day we'll do Secret Wars, which we'll do. One day we'll do Civil War and all this other stuff, Final Crisis, all that. But you can't do any of that without covering the importance of Crisis on Infinite Earths, because this would come after Marvel's Secret Wars, which was basically a big promotional comic event for action figures. It was still good, but that's really what it was. And it was the first time in the comic book industry they decided to go ahead and cross over all their characters in one main limited series, but also branch out into the other books like Amazing Spider-Man, where they actually took a 2-3 month hiatus, Fantastic Four, Avengers, Iron Man, etc. And DC was like, well, we could do it better. So they were like, you know, let's go ahead and do 12 issues where we're combining all of our continuities, because DC had a Golden Age and Silver Age continuity issue. Let's bring back and explain what's happened to a ton of characters that we haven't touched on for a while. Let's cross over into every book. And, you know, who was the artist over there? That was George Perez who did that. Let's bring him here and let him go freaking wild. And that's what brought us this. The comic event, as some called it, to end all comic events. Obviously, it didn't. But damn, did it set the standard going forward.
Indeed. I mean, you said it there. You can't really look at any other huge comic book events, whether they're directly related to this event, as many of the DC. There's a kind of a crisis trinity, I guess you might say. There's Crisis on Infinite Earths, Infinite Crisis, and Final Crisis. Yeah, that's basically the crisis trinity. There have been similar events, but they all play on each other. I guess Death Metal would kind of fall in there. They all sort of play on all previous crisis events. So to really properly cover any of those down the road, we had to cover this one. But even in the larger scope of just what crossover events are, I mean, for even though Secret Wars was before this, I feel like this is the one that yes, elements of Secret Wars kind of matter, but it was also kind of like a, you know, let's take a few months off and just have fun with characters battling each other in a consequence-free environment, for the most part. That's what it turned out to be. This is a crossover that actually literally changed the entire scope of the DC universe. It featured deaths that mattered, many, many deaths, I should say. I mean, like, in the billions, I guess, if you count all the universes. And it really, it has had lasting repercussions, and it's an event that is constantly referenced in DC continuity. So if you're a fan of DC Comics, or you're becoming a fan of DC Comics, and you want to understand the lore more, you really can't fully grasp the DC universe, the DC multiverse, any of it, without having the basis that we're going to look at here in Crisis on Infinite Earths. I'm having trouble saying infinite today.
Yeah, the title
Crisis on Infinite Earths.
The title doesn't really roll off the tongue, but I mean, I can't think of a better time to do this because we're a year out from Death Metal, which and Dark and you know Dark. I don't even freaking remember.
I always get them confused too. There's Death Metal and Dark Metal, Death Metal, Dark
Metal. Death Metal, like all that. So that was a Crisis event, and I didn't enjoy that. But, you know, it also came out, the pandemic, ironically, started around the time that the CW universe was doing.
Yeah, we had our own Crisis event.
Yeah, they had that. It was so funny. I remember going to the comic book store before they locked us down in Virginia, and on the sign it said, "We will remain open through the crisis." So I walk in after getting all my books, and I'm like, never in a million years that I think you guys would ever say you're going to remain open during the crisis. What is happening? Crisis on singular Earths. But
the skies are red, but damn it, we're staying it open.
But, you know, the CW shows, Arrow, Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, Batwoman, Supergirl, they all did their big crossover Infinite Crisis event, which was pretty good. And, you know, that had some big repercussions in terms of what the CW universe, the Arrow universe, as it was dubbed originally, would go through. But, you know, they also went ahead and did something crazy, and they actually brought in Ezra Miller, who played the Flash in Justice League and in the upcoming Flash film, to cross over as himself in that series. We also saw Burt Reynolds, the original Robin from the Adam West Batman series. We saw Burt Reynolds. Anyway, Burt, what's his name, who played Robin in the Adam West Batman? We saw who's the guy who played
Burt Ward.
Who's the guy who played the voice of Batman in the Batman the Animated series?
Kevin Conroy.
We don't know names, people. We also saw Brandon Routh, who plays the Atom in the CW universe, reprise his role as Superman. And what, this was crazy. We call him Kingdom Come Superman in that event. He is actually a continuation of the Richard Donner Superman. They did confirm that.
So just like you explained to me that Superman Returns movie was an extension of that, this is a version that is an extension of that version.
This is Christopher Reeve. It's basically that was crazy. And then they brought back, I mean, it was just freaking crazy. I think it's Sam Wellington from, I don't know names. I'm going to say Smallville Superman. They brought back freaking Smallville Superman. They just brought back everybody. And what DC really did with that was they showed, listen, we did this first. We did this best. This shit matters. And it's going to be insane. And I loved it.
And we are going to service the fans for six episodes.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
Yeah, that's the last WB anything I watched was Crisis, just out of curiosity. And it was. Times were hokey. Like, I thought the monitor was just extremely hokey, but whatever. It was what it was supposed to be. And it was certainly fun.
Oh, you'll hate what they did to Despero.
I don't want to know.
He's not an alien anymore.
I don't need to know these things. Earmuffs.
But yeah, I mean, when it comes to events, I mean, DC made sure to make their claim with this. And, you know, we thought about how do we condense 12 issues into a full show. But it's like, listen, to give this the respect and to make you better fans and everything else, we're covering this shit in three parts.
Indeed, yes, because you know, our wheelhouse, as we determined, is basically 4 to 6 issues. Probably 4 is a little better because we can give more time to things. So I think that was the best way to divide this up into into 3 episodes of 4 issues each. And just to give a little background, this was actually started to be conceived in like the early 80s. This was the brainchild of Marv Wolfman, who wrote the series. But I mean, they started planning this in like 1982, and he did. It was basically to address the multiverse. Like, he was writing some book, and I don't remember what it was. was, but he one character, like, I feel like it might have been Superman. I don't know. Let's just say it was. But and like basically he was fighting some character that he had just teamed up with like three issues before. And then they were like, oh, well, maybe that was from a different Earth, like Earth 2 or whatever. So then it made him start thinking like, man, this is really confusing for like new fans, like all these different multiverses. Like we gotta make things easier, make things make more sense. So because prior to that, DC had really embraced the multiverse. You know, they had like Earth 1 is basically like the current Earth of the times, where the characters were like normal age. And then there was also Earth 2, which had like the older like 40s and 50s or 30s to 40s versions of the characters. So it had the Justice League of Justice Society of America, had an older Superman, stuff like that. So basically this was trying to just wipe out the multiverse thing and merge everybody into ultimately at the end of this thing, one universe. And that is what happened. It certainly didn't stay that way. And now we have the exact opposite situation. But yeah, this was the basic idea. And of course, who could you bring on better than George Perez to draw? Literally, there have to be hundreds of characters in this realm. So it's absolutely insane. Pretty much any character that ever appeared in any DC comic, plus some characters that have appeared in other universes comics. What was it? The Charlton comics characters that they brought into?
The Charlton comics. They brought in some of the... I don't know who used to publish Shazam, Captain Marvel.
Kazam.
Oh, Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel, back when he was Captain Marvel. That was a different publisher. I mean, it was just, it was freaking crazy. And I mean, the one thing we're going to talk about a lot in this is the artwork. While Secret Wars may have, you know, happened before this, George Perez, and he stated this, had a hard time doing that book. And Rob Liefeld talks about it in his Robservations comic talking about Secret Wars. But you know, he was told by Marvel editorial and Marvel editor in chief Jim Shooter, you need to draw this so that when kids look at the panels, they could see how they could pose their action figures. So George Perez was like, I don't do it that way. And they were like, you're going to do this, because Mattel or whoever was doing the action figures was like, this is basically a big catalog for the action figures. So he even said he had to water down how he wanted to do panels and how he was going to draw characters because of that emphasis on selling the toys. So when he came over and Marv Wolfman was like, we're going to do this giant, crazy shit show that's never been done before, he was just like, George, I'm going to let you run loose. And I mean, the art quality between the two stories could not have been any more different.
Yeah, you can really tell that George Perez had the passion for this book and really... You know, there's so much detail, as there always is with George Perez artwork. Like, that's one thing I just love about George Perez. No matter how many freaking panels, you could have 32 panels on a page, and there will be so much detail in each one. Like, he leaves nothing to the imagination in a good way. He's like such a precise artist, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, he's been the inspiration for Alex Ross and so many other great artists. This book, you know, it's still, you know, art wise, while things do certainly change with the different eras and stuff like that, art wise, I mean, I would still argue that this is better quality than a lot of stuff we get even today. And he was doing this by hand. He didn't have a drawing board or, you know, a screen, a stylus. I mean, this was good old pen, paper and ink.
That being said, it's time to dive right into this puppy. We are finally doing it. Crisis on Infinite Earths, again, written by Mark Wolfman. I want to make everyone a Mark like me.
We don't do names here.
No, we don't. Written by Marv Wolfman, art by George Perez. And this was, this was bandied as a 12-part, as it says right on the cover, 12-part maxi series, which was not that common at the time. Like, usually you just had series, you know, and then eventually they ended. It wasn't very often you had, a planned out 12 issue maxi series, especially not one of this scope. And right off the bat, the cover's already awesome. Like, before I even get into the actual book, the cover's just awesome. It shows these multiple Earths, like with these sort of energy things coming from them. Some of your classic heroes, you see Superman, you see Firestorm. I don't know how classic he is, but I mean, somewhat, if you're a big fan of DC lore. Cyborg.
So you gotta give him that.
Yeah, he's a super friend. Fair enough. This character Pariah, who we shall meet on the inside. So just to point that out, I think the cover is just freaking badass. And it just tells you how epic this is going to be. It is actually like a 2-page spread cover too, if you have the original issues here. So, I mean, it's just totally badass. So diving right into this book, in the beginning, I'm going to be the universal narrator here. In the beginning, there was only one, a single black infinitude. And basically what happens here, this kind of reminded me a little bit, actually, of what we just read in Jack Kirby's Eternals, but much better. It's basically the history of the DC universe. So we're pretty much just seeing, like, it's basically, yeah, it's the history of the DC universe by Marv Wolfman. So basically, there's an explosion, I guess the Big Bang, you might call it, something to that effect. And during this explosion, the multiverse was born. And you see, like, all these multiple Earths and these sort of, like, you know, living in basically parallel realities here. And I love how George Perez illustrates this in art form. He has kind of like these thin veils between the Earths, and you can just kind of, like, I don't know. It's just a really unique way to portray that these are, like, in different dimensions, and they're all parallel, and they're all kind of the Earth we know, and they're none of them necessarily are either. One thing that always bugs me with any kind of multiversal story, and this is consistent in comics, in movies, whatever it may be, the Earth is always the center of everything. And I guess that's just because we're humans and we live on Earth and we're just from Earth. Humanity. So we're going to write stories about Earth. Yeah. But it's always like Earth 1, Earth 2. And then they almost refer to the multiverse as just as if they are Earths, as like Earth is the capital. So it's always about Earth 1, Earth 3, Earth 17, Earth 32. I don't know. It just always bugs me. Why not just call them the universes? Like, what makes Earth so freaking special? Just because we're here? Just because us humans are here?
Because we're here.
Well, yeah, I guess.
If you're not first, you're last.
This is indeed
Ricky Bobby
true.
Wisdom.
Yes. So there is this sort of mysterious narrator, and you know, he's saying this is the planet Earth, and in as many moments as it takes to comprehend its fate, this Earth will die. And we're just seeing slowly this version of Earth being encompassed by this kind of white light here. And we do learn that this character's name is Pariah, and he is basically just jumping from dying Earth to dying Earth. Again, it's always Earth. Why is he always on Earth? And he, like, jumps to these Earth. He even, like, tries to save this one kid, but the kid just disappears into nothingness. And then right as that's happening, he's like, no, I want to die too. Like, let me die. Like, clearly he's been trying to die for a while, or wanting to die for a while. And he's disappearing again just as this Earth is being destroyed. So basically this character, we'll get more into his actual origin. I think they'd lay it out in, like, a full issue that we won't get to today. But basically this guy jumps from universe to universe completely out of his control. And he just gets to universes right at these opportune moments, or unfortunate moments, maybe you would say, right when these worlds are being destroyed by whatever this force is that's destroying all these different worlds. And so he just gets to see a world die, and then he whips off to go see another world die. What a fucking terrible fate this guy has, huh?
Man, it's like being forced to watch the 2015 Fantastic Four on repeat.
I finally tried to watch it, and I didn't make it.
It's not worth it, bro. It's not worth it.
I know. I couldn't. It wasn't even bad. Good.
That's,
you know,
like,
it wasn't even
like Gitmo torture.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. But now we are moving to Earth 3. Now, Earth 3 is the home of who, Remzo? Who lives
the
on Earth
3? The Crime Syndicate. Dun, dun,
indeed.
Dun, 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 dun,
the Crime
dun.
Syndicate, who are basically just evil versions of our main DC heroes. So instead of Superman, we have Ultraman. Instead of Green Lantern, we have Power Ring, so on and so forth. And they are typically villains, but in this case, because their world is being destroyed, they are actually doing something somewhat heroic and trying to stop the world from destroying. So there's like volcanoes popping up, things are just crumbling, like everything's just going to hell. And there's just total mayhem before this white light, which we'll learn is like antimatter, basically, absorbs these worlds.
One of my guilty pleasure movies is The Day After Tomorrow with Dennis Quaid, and I always think of that movie when I see this segment.
I'm a 2020 guy myself.
2020 with Cusack is trash.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the whole point, but it's good trash. It's right on par with Day After Tomorrow. They're both garbage films that can be
enjoyable. I'll agree, disagree.
You have the right attitude. All right, fair enough. I think, who's your favorite member of the Crime Syndicate?
Owlman. Because he's
Owlman.
Batman.
Not even close.
Kills.
Yeah, it's not even close. He's Thomas Wayne, but really evil. Really evil. Always evil.
Yeah.
Thomas just, you know, depends on what universe he's in at the time. Yeah, so basically the Crime Syndicate is, because everything is reversed on Earth 3, so the Crime Syndicate are all these villains, and then who is the hero of Earth 3? It is, of course, Lex Luthor. And Lex Luthor looks absolutely fucking absurd in his outfit. He has this, like, I don't even know how to describe it. It kind of looks like the Guardian outfit. It's like this, the inverse of a Superman outfit, sort of. It's like red and blue, and then has a giant L, a giant yellow L on his chest to indicate Lex or Luthor or whatever. What do you think of Earth 3 Lex
Why
Luthor?
Is it the difference between Lex being good and Lex being bad is hair? And yeah, he's still bald, but he's got like
the, he has the goatee.
Yeah, like he's got that. Yeah. Like whenever Lex Luthor has hair, he's traditionally heroic. But when he doesn't have hair, he's evil. I think this is why I've always had trust issues of bald people.
Yeah, I agree. The bald are not to be trusted. No offense to any of our less hair fortunate listeners.
No. We have to draw some lines. We do not tolerate the balds here. They are untrustworthy.
But we will take their money. We will take their money.
We love the balds.
We will tolerate their money going into our SBC checking account. But yeah, basically Earth 3 is dying despite the efforts of the crime syndicate. Just like on the other Earth, they cannot really do shit to stop it. So Luthor sees he kind of sees the crime syndicate helping out, so he goes to join in to help out. He sees Superwoman, who is basically Wonder Woman, disappear, and he's like, well, shit, I guess this world's dying, better get home to my wife. His wife is of course Lois Lane in this universe, so I guess she's good in both Earth 1 and Earth 3. But they have this little baby, and he's like, hey, universe is dying, hun, what are we gonna do? She's like, but what about the baby? And he's like, come with me, I got a plan. So basically they're gonna find a way to save their little son, little baby Alexander Luthor, and they put him off in a pod somewhat reminiscent of how Superman was shot off in a pod as his world was dying on Krypton. Some parallels there perhaps. So yeah, basically as they shoot this little kid away, Lex and Lois make out as they disappear and die because Earth 3 is no more. These are the first serious deaths of characters that have been seen in the comics for the last 30 or 40 years. This completely wiped out the crime syndicate, though of course they will return. But not soon, not for a while. So it's as close to a meaningful deaths as we've had so far. And that I would say it lasts for a decent amount of time. It's a good amount of time before the crime syndicate is seen in DC Comics again. It might not even be until Final Crisis.
It's like 3 decades. Grant Moore.
Yeah, like I think it might not even be until around Final Crisis.
I have the JLA graphic novel that took place right before Final Crisis, where Grant Morrison was the one who brought back the concept of Earth 2 and the crime syndicate there. And when
Earth 3
and yeah. When the crime syndicate it comes back, they act like I won't spoil it because I want to cover that eventually, but like when they come back with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Indeed. So thus goes the fate of Earth 3, where meanwhile Alexander Luthor ends up landing somewhere, and spoiler alert, it is Earth 1 that he has been sent to. Meanwhile, some dude who we don't see yet, spoiler alert, it's the Monitor, him and this chick Lila, they're just hanging out in this satellite space station and watching worlds die, basically. they're doing what the name of the Monitor implies. They are monitoring, and they're just seeing these worlds die. And then this Monitor guy is talking to this Lila chick, and he wants her to retrieve this little baby Luthor, this little baby Alexander Luthor, and also to gather these. He says we're going to need both heroes and villains to tackle this crisis that's destroying all these universes here. So she turns into, basically Lila turns into Harbinger, and Harbinger is a combination of all the versions of Lila from across the multiverse merge into one. So when it's Harbinger, it's all of them. When it's Lila, it's just this one that's hanging out with Monitor. Confused yet?
Well, it kind of reminds me of some of my ex-girlfriends with split personalities. So, but they'll never admit it. It's just a rough day.
And they're the most dangerous and powerful. They're the most dangerous and powerful when all the split personalities are complaining at once.
When they have their wits about them.
Yeah, so basically now Lila goes off. It's kind of heist movie time. It's where we're going to gather the team together. And boy, is this some kind of obscure team. And there's going to be a lot
of music in the background. Dun, dun,
yes,
dun, dun, dun,
there's going to be. There's going to be a lot of me tossing to you here, Remzo, so I hope you're ready for a little bit of a speed round, because first up, we go to the jungles of Africa, where we actually go to an Africa known only to a few. This is Gorilla City, which is ruled by the somewhat benevolent king, it seems, King Solovar. Remzo, what can you tell me about King Solovar?
King Solovar first appeared in the pages of The Flash. This is where you'll get certain characters such as Gorilla Grodd and others, the Prime Simian, who are all these evil ape villains.
Prime Simian. I love that name.
And basically it's a city run by basically super intelligent apes, but because they're afraid of the world of man, which is constantly warring with each other and destroying the planet, they went ahead and basically pulled a Wakanda and they made their city invisible and nobody's allowed in. And King Solovar is a gentle king, and his super high skill is the getaway driver. I'm joking. He's just cool.
All right. So as King Solivar is delivering a very kind verdict to an ape here, he is visited by Harbinger, who just grabs him and they zip off. So they've gone somewhere. Next up is Dawnstar. Remzo, what can you tell me about Dawnstar?
Dawnstar is hot. Dawnstar is from the future, and Dawnstar has wings, and Dawnstar is part of the Legion of Superheroes.
That's all you need to know. She does have a smokingly seductive outfit.
God bless you, George Perez.
Yes, God bless you. Who
we last week learned is still alive.
we're obviously going across both different worlds and different times. So we've gone to King Solivar, who I think was basically from the present of Earth One. Now we're going to the Legion of Superheroes 30,000 years in the future, which I think is still Earth One, but in the future. We then though go to 1942 on Earth Two, where Harbinger collects Firebrand. I don't know anything about Firebrand. I'm not even gonna tee you up. But do you know anything about Firebrand?
Firebrand does not matter.
That's what I thought. Firebrand does not matter. Yes, that's a good summary of her. Meanwhile, we do kind of see while all this is going on, I just put in my notes, someone evil is watching. that's all we know. But someone is watching these events unfold that is not the Monitor, and someone is doing that with quite a bit of interest. We then meet Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle. Remzo, what can you tell me about Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle?
Ted Kord is Batman if Batman was stupid.
Perfect. Moving on. She then goes back again in time. I think this is like 30,000 years in the past. And she is like there to get this guy, Arion, who is basically like some fucking Atlantean wizard, essentially. But while she's trying to do that, she sees something. She sees some kind of like shadowy creature. And she says like, what? Not you. No. So she kind of takes off and goes somewhere else at first. She's like, yeah, maybe I'll come back to that guy later. She then goes and shows up. This is now on Earth 2 in the present. Again, so Earth 2 is like the home of older Superman, of the Justice Society, etc. She goes to recruit Roger Hayden, a.k.a. the Psycho Pirate, and she does provide him with his Medusa mask, which is what provides him his powers and also kind of drives him completely insane. Remzo, what can you tell me about the Psycho Pirate?
I don't really know.
All right, fair enough. He has the Medusa mask, though, and he controls him. So this might be one for me. The Psycho Pirate is Roger Hayden. At some point, for somehow, some reason, I'm not sure how, he found and came into possession of the Medusa mask. The Medusa mask allows him to control and manipulate the emotions of others, while he also basically gets high on that. So the more he controls the emotions of others, the more he kind of like gets super high on it and like starts to lose his own mind in it. So hence the Psycho Pirate.
Oh, so he's like the media.
Yes. He's the mainstream media, essentially, is what the Psycho Pirate is.
I got you now.
Somewhere along the way through the narration here, she also goes in and does finally go back and fetch this Arion character as well. She like saves him when he's falling down an iceberg or some shit and collects him too. Also, she goes and collects. So basically Firestorm is, this is on Earth One now. Firestorm, who is comprised of two people merged into one, some teenager and this professor guy. We're not going to go into all that whole thing, along with Killer Frost. If you want to know some version of their origins, you can watch them on the early seasons of the WB Flash. But he's battling Killer Frost. And Harbinger shows up here now. So now she's not just showing up to collect someone. She's also showing up to manipulate someone. And this is kind of why they have the Psycho Pirate, because Killer Frost is a villain. She normally isn't really interested in helping humanity so much. But Harbinger has Psycho Pirate manipulate her emotions and feel love. And so he basically imbues her with the emotion of love so that she'll care more about the Earth and saving humanity. But what happens in the meantime, she's like looking at Firestorm when this happens. So she not only does agree to help the team because now she loves people and everything, but she also falls in love with Firestorm. And this is kind of like an ongoing gag, at least through these first few issues here, where whenever they're trying to get stuff done and do things, these former feuding villains and heroes are now sort of like Firestorm is basically not interested at all. But Killer Frost is like relentlessly all over him for the rest of this thing.
Man, when the universe is getting erased by some type of like, you know, energy shit, the worst thing you could do is get laid. Come on,
yeah,
Firestorm.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with Killer Frost is I think if you touch her, you like turn into ice. So I think
the nuclear man can go ahead and heat things up.
There you go. Yeah. She's like Rogue. She's like, bounch, you know, she's very tempting, but bounch, there are consequences bounch, to going there. Bounch, bounch, bounch. We then learn through narration. So like the monitor, he monitors things. He knows things. He's like a more active watcher, I guess, and a more ridiculous looking watcher. He knows that Lila is going to kill himself, is going to kill him. So like, that's just like information he has. So that's just a little planting a little seed for later. Then we get this crazy 2-page hero spread where they're all in the monitor satellite, just kind of like trying to figure out what the fuck they're doing there. And boy, there are a lot of characters in here. I'm just going to rattle some of them off. We've got Cyborg. We've got the older Earth 2 Superman. We've got Obsidian. We've got Dr. Polaris. We've got Simon. We've got Geo-Force. Let's try this one, Ramzo. What can you tell me about Geo-Force?
Geo-Force is the prince of a fake country in Eastern Europe I cannot remember, and he was kidnapped by some scientists in order to basically be experimented on as a super soldier. Geo-Force can go ahead and pull the powers of all of Earth's elements, wind, earth, fire, water, and bend them to his will. But each time he does
very
so,
impressive.
He takes off a small chunk of his life.
Oh, I did not know that. So, yeah, I'm very impressed with your Geo-Force knowledge. That is why you are here, Remzo.
Geo-Force was one of my favorite characters, not only in the mid-2000s Justice League run, but he was also one of the original members of Batman and the Outsiders.
I think we have found the world's first Geo-Force fan right here in Remzo Martinez.
I admire Geo-Force. He's noble, he's heroic, but he's also one of these like tragic hero characters where he does so more.
Maybe you'll produce a whole Geo-Force episode for us one day then.
I could create a better Geo-Force comic book than Max Abrams can write Spider-Man.
I mean, that's a pretty low bar, but fair enough. I'm sure that's true. That should be our goal. Let's aim at getting a Geo-Force book someday. By SBC
DC,
Nation.
If you're listening, I will write this shit for free.
I'll learn to ink. I don't think I could do the art, but maybe I could learn to ink. I don't know. I'm just tracing over other people's stuff, right? No offense to professional inkers out there. I'm sure it's much more complicated than that.
You're gonna get like a quill in the mail dipped in blood.
You think it's just ink? Basically they're in the satellite. Trying to figure out what's going on when these shadow creatures show up and start attacking. And basically they just battle all these shadow creatures. One thing that stood out to me here is Dr. Polaris. Do you know what he called himself at one point during this battle? He called himself the Master of Magnetism. What a son of a bitch. He's not the fucking Master of Magnetism.
That's some trademark dispute right there.
That is Magneto, all right? Magneto is the master of magnetism in my world, my friends. We also have Green Lantern John Stewart there, too. I'm not sure which Earth he's from. I think Earth 1.
He only exists in Earth 1.
Okay. So, basically they're just battling all these shadow creatures. And then basically the monitor presses a button and like zips them off. So I guess he could have stopped this at any point in time, it seems. And then as we wrap up this issue, we get a full page spread of the monitor. And he says, "Now let me properly introduce myself. I am the monitor. And I have summoned you here because your universes are about to die." And I will say the monitor looks about as ridiculous as Ajax did in Jack Kirby's Eternals.
And he certainly didn't look any better in the live action CW.
No, he looked absurd.
Yeah, some things need to be changed. Sometimes comic accuracy is not what you want.
Yeah, I would have been fine if they went for a completely different look for him. But that wraps up the first issue of Crisis on Infinite Earths. What are you thinking? First of all, I didn't ask you this earlier. When did you first read this story? How long has it been since that time?
I read it in high school. I don't remember much. I read it and I flipped through that obligation, but I didn't really like read it until last year when I picked it up in a trade paperback form. DC went ahead and did another printing of this to tie it into the CW Infinite Crisis. So I got a fresh trade back copy with a brand new Alex Ross cover on it. It was awesome.
All right. Excellent. Well, so how did this hold up then? I guess it's only been a year, so it's somewhat fresh
for
you.
It just keeps moving. I mean, I like the dynamic nature of the storytelling. Marv Wolfman and George Perez, like they're a creative team that really meshes together really well and kept my attention throughout. Love it.
Indeed, yeah. Same with me. I mean, I think we were a little intimidated to dive into it just because there's so much here, so many characters. It is a massive story. But when you're actually reading it, it does kind of fly, even though there's a lot there. There's a lot of like art to look at. Like, again, George Perez is so detailed. A lot of pages have like 8 to 10 very detailed panels. So there's a lot to look at. But the story itself, it kind of just does fly by. So I was pleasantly surprised by that.
Yeah. So on to issue two, we pick up in a time far, far away on another Earth. We basically see that this caveman society is noticing that something is changing about the Force. And you've got this one guy who goes back to his tribe and he's like, people, I've seen some weird shit, like something is not good in the jungle hood. And they're like, bro, what do you mean? We ride mammoths and stuff like that. Things here usually aren't good. And he's like, wait, you got to see this. So they go over, and what they basically see is that time and space and everything is merging. So out of nowhere in this prehistoric forest, a city from the 31st century pops up. And this is where we go ahead and see the Legion of Superheroes. We see Brainiac 5 and Chameleon Boy and Phantom Girl and Wildfire and Lightning Glass and Colossal Boy. The Legion of Stupid Names. Basically, they're freaking out because they're like, oh my gosh, look, something's wrong. All these caveman people are here. You got mammoths jumping around the city, and like things are not good. And that's when they start realizing, wait a second, our universe is collapsing in on itself. It's causing a bend in the time-space continuum. So, you know, at one point, a whole bunch of like future soldiers about to shoot these mammoths, but all of a sudden the mammoths disappear and they're just like, what the heck is happening? That's when we go back to Earth One and we go ahead and see the Joker. The Joker has just murdered somebody, and before he can go ahead and escape, Batman, this is the first time we've seen Batman so far, comes in crashing through the window. I can almost hear that Tim Burton music in the background from the 89 Batman. Da, 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 da. It's awesome. And as they're fighting, the Joker goes ahead and shoots him with this pistol that basically shoots out like this liquid concrete. So basically Batman is almost down, and the Joker could actually go over and kill him, but something happens. Something super strange happens. We see this portal jump up through the other room, and we see a dying Flash, a dying Barry Allen shoot through, and he looks almost like a walking skeleton. He's screaming, help me, anyone, please. And then he disappears. So at this point, right before he disappears, I mean,
did this remind you of anything?
This reminded me of the nightmare sequence vision in yes. Batman versus Superman, where the Flash goes to the
very
past.
Much so. It's very, very reminiscent.
Yeah.
Or other way around, yeah. I guess that would be reminiscent of this.
Yeah, so basically the Joker is freaking out, and he's pointing his gun at Barry Allen, and he's like, no fair, speedster. Your own town, Central City. Tell him, Batman, he's got no jurisdiction here.
I love that line. It's so hilarious. He's like, what the fuck? No, I don't deal with superpowered shit here. I just fight Batman. When is this?
This ain't fair. So before he could go ahead and shoot, Batman quickly gets out of that like liquid concrete shit because he's Batman, and he disposed of the Joker real fast, only a run over to this Flash, and he's just like, what's going on, man? Like, what's happening? And the Flash is still talking to him. He's exuding this weird energy, and he's like, please, can't you see the world? I'm dying. It's all around me. Iris. And Batman's just like, this is just really, really weird. So Flash is like, Flash, like, where are you? What are you talking about? I can help you. Like, he can obviously tell, like, the Flash is between time or something. Batman has a degree of knowledge about the Speed Force. But as he starts doing that, the Flash literally just turns to ash right in front of him. And Batman actually freaks out, and he's like, he's disintegrating before my eyes. Dear God, what is happening? And we see something we've never seen in Batman before. We see fear. So now we're back at the monitor's lair. And at this point, he's like, I am the monitor, and I have summoned you here because your universes are about to die. And he basically,
this two page spread is just insane. It's here, with all these characters and all the Earths. And there's how many panels are here? There's like the two long ones, and then there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, like just such unique layouts from George Perez. To he can pack so much into like a page. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And long story short, and this covers the next couple pages, the monitor is basically, and this is more so for the reader than just the characters, but he's describing how the multiverse works. Basically, it's not like time travel. It's not like parallel Earths. Multiverses, and we've covered this on the show a lot, but I want to be really succinct here. It's two worlds that are similar to each other, but they move at their own unique pace. So it's not always just anti versions of certain characters. You might have, like, you know, a John, you know, we'll call him a Clark Kent here and a Clark Kent there, but they could live very different lives, experience very different things, experience very different people. And through every action that we make on Earth One, it creates these other parallel multiverse Earths. So basically what's happening, because there are far too many Earths, the Monitor is dealing with this other version called the Anti-Monitor. And the Anti-Monitor is basically this giant cosmic force that was created in the Big Bang that was supposed to basically reset the multiverse when it got too big. So the Monitor, who wants to find a way to balance it because he's been watching existence, he's kind of like the Watcher, he wants to go ahead and try and save it. So what he's done is he's pulled the best heroes and the most powerful characters from across the multiverse to band together to basically try and save existence before more Earths go ahead and get crushed by the wave of the antimatter power thing that the Anti-Monitor uses to basically kill Earths. And that's where we're at.
Indeed, that's a pretty good summary.
So now...
I'll make sense now. But the only question is, what are these guys going to do about it?
They're going to try something. And
what's this giant gorilla going to do about it? Like, that's the part that's a little bit confounding.
When you're facing existence.
That's true.
But anyway, the Guardians of Oa, the leaders of the Green Lantern Corps, start noticing that the giant Green Lantern beacon, which powers all of the lanterns as well as their power rings, something's happening. And it's basically imbalanced by the antimatter wave that's coming about. So it actually blows up and knocks out all the Guardians. So, you know, that's some mean shit. Meanwhile, we're back at Metropolis on Earth One. This is when we actually see our main Superman, and he meets up with Batman, who's at the Daily Planet during the day, which makes Superman realize that some weird shit is happening. And
he's awake right now. Holy shit.
He's like, if Batman's out in my town in the day, something is wrong. So basically he gives him a brief synopsis of, he just watched the Flash disintegrate and talk about the end of days. And then next thing you know, Pariah jumps in and he's like, oh my gosh, I'm here. Praise heaven, help at last. Because what Pariah wants to do is he wants to stop witnessing all this death and destruction. So he knows who Batman, Superman are. And for like three mini panels, they're just like, who the hell is this guy?
I love the tiny panels with just them looking at, like, what the fuck is this guy? it's so effective and so hilarious.
Yeah, but basically before Pariah can say really anything, he's like, I'm Pariah and I need your help. And blah, and he basically gets pulled to go witness another Earth get destroyed. Meanwhile, we're back in the 30th century, a full century before the Legion of Superheroes. And what we see is Kamadi, the last boy on Earth.
No, now I think. Oh, no. Okay. Did he get transferred to the 30th century, or was the other way? Yeah, you're right.
So he's the last boy on Earth. He's climbing this tower and he's basically like, you know, so I'm noticing some
Kamadi.
That's his name. I'm witnessing some weird shit happening. He witnesses one of those shadow creatures, and what the shadow creature does is it cuts his rope that he was using to climb up this tower, and who saves him? Earth 2 Superman. And they're basically like, hey man, listen, we're recruiting some people for a heist. No, I'm joking. We're recruiting some people.
I love too that Superman's like, who the fuck are you? Then it's like, oh yeah, multiple Earths. You probably met one of the other guys.
Yeah. So basically, they're recruiting more people for the Monitor, and they're dealing with more of these, shadow people. But the shadow people actually begin to mimic the powers of other heroes. So at one point they mimic the King, and then they start even mimicking Superman and Dawnstar. So they realize that these aren't just average goons. These goons are goons who can adapt. Meanwhile,
I love how King Solovar just jumps on one of them at one point, and it's actually effective. Like that's his power. I'm a big gorilla who jumps on shadow creatures.
Yeah, at this point, what we notice is on top of that giant tower that appeared in the 30th century that Kamadi was climbing up, we see that this was actually a device that formed around the shuttle that shot young Alexander Luther Jr. into another universe. So basically it's not like Superman's shuttle that just sent him to another planet. This went ahead and sent out, you know, Lex Luthor's son from that one Earth, Earth 3, into a safe safe universe. So basically,
and despite having no food, this baby is growing fast. He's like 5 years old. Well,
I'll quickly explain it. But when he was traveling through the multiverse and everything, it messed with his DNA. So he actually ages faster. So within a day, he's already become 5 years old. And as they're basically, you know, trying to figure out like what's going on, they're recruiting more people. Pariah shoots up again before Psycho Pirate, and he's just like freaking out. Psycho Pirate tries to go ahead and control Pariah to get him to, you know, tell him more. But that one wizard guy, that Lantean wizard dude, shoots up behind him. And Arion jumps up behind him and knocks out Psycho Pirate. Meanwhile, they get attacked by another swarm of shadow people. Moving on past that, some dialogue that doesn't really matter about Psycho Pirate. We go back to the Anti-Monitor's lair, and the Anti-Monitor's the Monitor's lair, and he's basically like, you know, maybe this team isn't all perfect because Psycho Pirate's going mad and he's fighting his teammates. And he's talking to Lila, and he's just like, hey, you know, like we have to continue to recruit people, and we have to go more places because this team just isn't strong enough. One of those people we're going to find is the new Dr. Light. It is time for me to create her. So basically what he's doing is now he's going to other multiverses to create stronger versions of characters on other planets. Meanwhile,
And the original Dr. Light was, I believe, a villain from, I think, Earth 2.
Kind of a villain. He's a evil SOB. So basically, at this point, he's using Harbinger to basically become more powerful, to become more omnipotent. So that way he can go ahead and have her go beyond the multiverses that even they can see and recruit stronger, more efficient heroes. And that is the end of issue 2.
I mean, despite the fact that there's a lot going on, somehow they're able to do everything where it's actually not hard to follow. Like all the characters are kind of in their own little sections doing their own different things. They always clearly tell you, unlike a lot of modern writers. I like when they tell you, okay, now we're in 30,000 BC. Now we're in this year, because that can be confusing. And a lot of writers nowadays just like make you figure it out. I don't find that fun. Just tell me when the fuck things are, you know?
Yeah. Like I know some people might say, oh, I'm glossing over a lot, but the one thing is like, there's so much in here that for audio purposes, I have to just give you the things that immediately jump out and the stuff that's keeping the story further, because there's a lot of dialogue. There's a full page monologue with Psycho Pirate that is interesting, but it doesn't serve the grand purposes. And it's there to give more character development, which I really like about this, because with ensemble books and with big event books like this, especially when you're bringing in characters who aren't usually that popular, it's a good time to develop them. So like Psycho Pirate here actually gets a lot of development, but it's
a huge role in this.
It's one of those things where it's like, for our purposes, I'm going to just tell you some books are worth reading. And I'm hoping that we're giving you enough of an idea and our thoughts on this. But some of this stuff, like, you've got to read it to get the full experience.
For sure. And one thing interesting about Psycho Pirate in particular is throughout the rest of DC history, no matter what crisis events occur, no matter what a version of Psycho Pirate it is, Psycho Pirate remembers all crisis events. And he is actually a crucial part of a lot of them. So he is a character, while relatively minor. Yeah.
Yeah. He was big in that Infinite Crisis series. I'm sorry. No, Infinite Frontier.
Infinite Frontier. Yeah. I think I called it Infinite Crisis for all of the potpourri episode we just did. Infinite Frontier. Correct. Yeah. He's big in that. He's big in Death Metal. I mean, he's like this minor character who ends up serving a lot of importance throughout a lot of major DC stories. So he's definitely someone of interest. And I always find it interesting that he knows everything. So the version of Psycho Pirate that you currently see in the DC universe, he remembers this shit. He knows all about this stuff. One of the few characters that does. Yeah. Psycho Pirate fact of the day. Moving on to issue number 3 of Crisis on Infinite Earths, we see now the Monitor in his little lair along with Harbinger. They're doing tests on Alexander Luthor, and Monitor's like, astounding, I've never seen the likes of your kind before. In the space of, what is this? In the space of days, you have aged from infancy to adolescence. So he's like a teenager now, and he's just naked being held in this bubble. He's like, you child of Earth 3, son of Alexander and Lois Luthor, you are remarkable. remarkable for reasons far beyond your rapid aging. And he's just like, can I get out of this fucking bubble, dude? He's like, wow, you look at yourself, child. You are an anomaly. Positive and negative matter existing within one form. An impossibility. So Monitor basically represents like matter. Anti-Monitor represents anti-matter. And somehow, because of how they shot Alexander Luther through the multiverse or whatever, he consists of both. Why does this make sense, Remzo?
Because comics.
Thank you very much. Moving along. So basically, we are now on Earth. So we actually see here that Psycho Pirate has basically been taken somewhere else. And it appears he is now, along with Lila, Lila slash Harbinger is now like a double agent. So Monitor sends Lila off, but now she's appearing somewhere else. It wasn't clear when it happened, but I think what happened before, when they had that little battle with Psycho Pirate, he disappeared. That was actually the Anti-Monitor taking Psycho Pirate away So now we only see the Anti-Monitor like in shadow form. So
Psycho Pirate has no real desire to save the Earth or the multiverse. Big thing is like, you know, I'm doing what I need to do for survival purposes.
He was like, this bitch gave me my Medusa mask back, so I'll hang out for a minute. But yeah, he quickly turned on things, and now he is there working with the Anti-Monitor, who we haven't actually seen yet, but we kind of see him speaking in the shadows, and we pretty much know who it is, as is Lila, as is the Harbinger. So they are both double agents. Psycho's not a double agent. Psycho Pirate's kind of gone anyway, but Harbinger is a double agent, as it's already been referenced, as we already kind of, it's been alluded that she is going to eventually kill the Monitor here, but they are directly now working with the Anti-Monitor. We then go back to Earth One, but Earth One 30,000 years in the future, where we see the Flash. Now, this comes off the heels of the Flash number 350, which culminated the trial of the Flash storyline and ended the current Flash book at the time. And then it would later be revamped with what's his name? Who's the other
Wally
Flash?
Wally West.
Thank you, Wally West. And I think Mark Waid had like the best run on the Wally West Flash. I'll definitely get into that at some point. But yeah, Mark Waid's Flash run is just absolutely historic. Wally West was always my Flash. Even though like Barry Allen is the classic Flash, 90s Wally West was the only Flash to me, because this Flash, well, we'll get there. Let's just say, yeah, well, we'll just get there. I don't want to spoil this for anyone that doesn't know this storyline yet, but anyway, at the end of that event, Flash disappears. But where did he go? He went 30,000 years in the future, to the same time as the Legion of Superheroes. So that's where he's been living for like the last month of his own life, essentially. He was basically like living the life of a non-hero. He was actually trying to just be like a guy living in the future, like not being the Flash anymore. But because of all this multiverse shit, shit is going bad. There's there's random like weather events and such, and like I think, let's see, it's like the Empire State Building like from the past appears in this version of I'm looking on a different Earth now. I jumped ahead. Basically this future Earth, this 31st century Earth, is starting to like be destroyed with all sorts of cataclysms and such. And as Flash is running around trying to help it, he sees this like white light, the antimatter, coming right at him. He's like, it's coming right at me, only one chance, I pray to. And we don't really see what happens, but the Flash does disappear at this point. So he escaped and went off to the 30th century, and guy can't even get a month break before shit goes down again. We then head over to Earth One, July 1985, which is basically the present day, and all these heroes are seeing weird stuff happen. So now we have basically the Outsiders and the Teen Titans are teaming up to deal with stuff, to deal with like buildings collapsing again, like shit is just falling apart on all these multiverses and all these different Earths as the multiverse continues to collapse. While all this is going on, Superman shows up. Earth One, regular age Superman shows up and saves Wonder Girl, and that's when he, along with Batman, show up to recruit these heroes, because they're like, look, we don't actually have any clue what's going on. Still, we met this weird guy, he was there for 5 seconds and we looked at each other confused and he disappeared, but according to him, something's going on with the multiverse and all these different Earths are disappearing, and I have no fucking clue what we're going to do about it, but we need your help. So that is the summary of how Superman and Batman recruit the rest of these heroes. I also like, too, like as this like white light, like antimatter stuff is coming, like what's her name? Starfire. Starfire is just shooting at it, like just shooting at nothing. And Superman just grabs her. He's like, yeah, that just stop. That's not going to do anything. It's having no effect.
They're too pretty to comprehend this.
Right. So as they're trying to figure out what they're going to do, who appears again? It's the Flash. The Flash is there again, and Flash sees Batman. He's like, Batman, thank heaven. I relaxed my internal vibrations. It brought me back to this time. Something's happening in the future. Everything's unraveling, fraying at the seams, and Batman, with this very shocked look on his face, saying, Flash, calm down. I have to speak with you. He's like, no. I feel so strange. What's happening to me? And Batman says, that glowing. If I can pull him free, I've got to stop him before the image I saw comes true. And at that point, there's this character, Jericho. Do you know? Rebzo, what can you tell me about Jericho?
Jericho is the son of Deathstroke. Jericho is mute, but he also has the ability to jump bodies between people.
Yeah, so Jericho basically just jumps and stops Batman here. He says he can't, in his internal monologue, we see that he can't let whatever surrounds the Flash affect the Dark Knight too. So Jericho stops Batman from basically joining the Flash, who again, he's saying, oh my God, oh my God, my God, I tried warning you, help me. And the Flash just disappears again. So basically, whatever the Flash did to escape his fate in the 31st century sent him jumping through time and apparently to different times of Batman to see him. So it's interesting that there is this kind of Flash Batman connection even here as Flash is traveling back through time, trying to get help. And it's very reminiscent again. Well, I guess it's not reverse reminiscence, I guess, of what's the story? Storyline where
Nightmare,
where they found the button.
It's called the button.
Yeah, they and also in Flashpoint, like Flash and Batman are always sort of inexorably linked in interesting ways in all these sort of crisis events.
What's really tragic about this, and this is really my only big comment here, is like the Flash was always before this like the comedic relief in the Justice League. He's always, while he's been an adult, he was always kind of portrayed as a kid, despite the fact that he's a pretty serious hero. To see him suffering, to see him genuinely fearful, to see him in the state where, you know, like he's just purely horrified by what's happening. It's almost kind of heartbreaking because this is supposed to be like the end of the age of innocence for DC Comics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll continue on with the story in the third episode of this. But like it gets really tragic. And I mean, the Flash has always been important. We did last year, we did the Flashpoint episode where Flashpoint really made him a big part, like an actual, like, you know, he's on the Mount Rushmore of DC Comics. But, you know, while that definitely solidified him as somebody truly important, like somebody that really matters, Crisis on Infinite Earths really sets up Flash as the heart of DC. And that's both good and sad because of, you know, what's happening and what does happen later.
And moving along, we now see after Flash disappears, we now go and see Brainiac in space. Remzo, what can you tell me about Brainiac?
Brainiac was supposed to be a surveyor robot, but he gained sentience and decided that humanity needed to be wiped out. But because he's a prime intelligence, he can't just go ahead and kill everything. So what he does, he goes between planet to planet, shrinking cities into tiny bottles that he displays in his Brainiac hive mind spaceship, collecting them so that way he can further research them and allow his intelligence to further grow. This Brainiac used to be formed of organic matter, but he realized that was keeping him too soft, too slow. So he went ahead and shed that more alien appearance. He was basically like a green Lex Luthor. And now what he's done is he's put himself into a purely robotic zombie that's reminiscent of the Terminator. So now we're seeing Terminator Brainiac figure out that all is not right in his world.
Yeah, and Brainiac is going through space, like you said, kind of figuring out that things are going bad here. And he thinks to himself, oh, yeah, I know somebody who can help me out who's also pretty evil. How about Lex Luthor? So he's headed to Earth to recruit Lex Luthor. But there's one panel that I really like here, and it's something that's been consistent over a number of characters that don't usually express this emotion. But it says, Brainiac is a living computer steeped in logic, devoid of emotion. Yet now, for the first time since his conversion, Brainiac experiences fear. And we also saw this with Superman expressing fear, who, like, we hardly ever see him afraid of anything. Batman afraid. We saw Flash, like, just absolutely trembling in fear with what's going on. So they're really doing a good job of conveying that all these characters, even ones that are normally either devoid of fear or have nothing to fear because they're so powerful, or you are creatures of logic and reason even, and so they don't experience emotions, all of them universally are experiencing fear over what's going on. And I think that's just it's very effective throughout these early issues here.
I love this next part. We go back. I'm sorry, Mark, but this I have to talk about this.
Please roll with it. Roll with it. This is where things get crazy.
Between emerging of the 30th century, the 13th century, and our modern times. And basically what we see is a giant Nazi alien caveman fight occurring. But what we see is our heroes fighting these evil space Nazis and stuff. We see Sergeant Rock as well as the ghost tank. Do you know what the ghost tank is?
I'm not familiar with the ghost tank. I know Sergeant Rock.
We've got the ghost tank, which is it's not an Abrams. The Abrams wasn't around yet. Anyway, it's a tank that's been possessed by the ghost of Confederate General Jeb Stuart. Basically,
that's hilarious. Now I get why he's say. Okay, now I see why he's thinking to himself, Jeb. So he's psychically communicating with the ghost that's controlling this tank. So
basically,
wow. That makes this sense and less sense at the same time.
Depending on continuity, because I don't know if it was Dark Horse or IDW. They did a ghost tank series like 5 years ago. DC no longer has the rights to this character. But long story short,
who does? Can we get the rights to this character?
I don't think it's culturally appropriate now.
A second print publication. Ghost tank.
What's
Come
ghost
on.
Tank about?
If anybody
about
can do it, it's
us. Confederate general who haunts a tank, and basically helps.
We can make it about a World War II vet or something. We can. It wouldn't have the same charm then.
You get the idea for ghost tank? Long story short, Jeb Stuart possesses a tank. That's it.
That's amazing. I also put in my notes here, like they're battling, like they're in the middle of real World War II when they get like transported to like the 30th century, or it's not even clear where they exactly are right now. But basically, Nazis are fighting amongst our heroes amongst one of these crazy tower things. And by the way, they're just abusing the shit out of the Nazis. Like, I'm not I've defended drug dealers and such in the past. I'm not going to defend the Nazis, but I will say maybe they shouldn't be systematically abused. Like,
you already said you wanted to do a comic book about Confederate general who possesses a tank.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, they're like, and these army guys are like, this is how you handle goose steppers, four eyes, and they're just beating them with the buzz of their guns while this other crazy other battle is going on. It's just nonsense. And of course, our good friends Geo-Force and Dr. Polaris play a big part in this battle, as well as the Blue Beetle. So there's just a shit going on. Like, it's World War II plus Crisis on Infinite Earths is also happening in the middle of this, and it's just absolute madness. This section, this very long section, I should add.
Talking?
Yeah, I now get it. I was so confused by the tank thing. So I'm glad, and thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
Also, Ted Kord is like acting like he's just learning the Blue Beetle thing. So did he just recently become Blue Beetle? Because I believe there was another Blue Beetle before him.
No, he's the first Blue Beetle. You have Jaime Reyes, who's the current Blue Beetle, who's actually the cool one. This is Ted Kord, who is...
Why is he acting so confused by
Ted
the powers?
Kord has never been interesting. His thing is always he's the new superhero, despite the fact that he's not new. But that's the gimmick they tried to do with him. Like, he's just trying to figure out.
Oh, no, you're wrong, Remzo. Actually, my very fast research skills have revealed to me. No. So Ted Kord is the first DC Comics Blue Beetle, but he was a Charlton character. And that name, the name of that Blue Beetle was Dan Garrett. And Ted Kord does reference Dan Garrett here.
He's not continuity. Oh, he's continuity.
He must be, because he references him here in the dialogue. He's like, oh, Garrett never told me about that, or something like that. You know, he references his name.
For every ghost tank fact I know something less about Blue Beetle.
Fair enough. Yeah, basically they say, okay, so what happened here, this is on Wikipedia telling me, so that's my source here, but he says the second Blue Beetle was created by Charlton and taken over by DC Comics. So the original Blue Beetle was a Charlton character named Dan Garrett. The successor to Dan Garrett was known as Ted Kord. Ted Kord then jumped to the DC Comics universe during Crisis on Infinite Earths. So this is actually where it happened. So both are true. Ted Kord had recently taken on the mantle of Blue Beetle in Charlton Comics, and this is his debut in DC Comics, flipping over from there during this very event. So this is actually his DC Comics debut, not his debut as a character. Boom. We both learned more about Blue Beetle today than we ever knew. Yeah. But meanwhile, Sergeant Rock and friends are still killing Nazis and shooting space pirates or whatever the fuck is going on here. In the middle of all this stuff, who shows up again? Those shadow creatures. So they show up, and basically while this is going on, like, soldiers start disappearing, and everybody starts disappearing. and people are just disappearing here. Yeah, like Blue Beetle, it gets attacked by a shadow creature. Him and Geo-Force and Dr. Polaris are basically, you know, the main team here. While Monitor is kind of, you know, he's watching over things and seeing these events unfold and seeing more and more people just disappear they're basically trying to protect these, like, these different devices that the Monitor placed in these different realities and different times, which are supposed to fend off this wave of antimatter from the anti-Monitor. If that makes sense. Meanwhile, we see a touching moment between King Solivar and Kamandi they've become apparently very fast friends here. Kamandi being sort of a jungle boy and King Solivar being a very kind gorilla king. And they're kind of having a touching moment where Solivar starts to feel pretty weird. He's like, nope, something's feeling weird. And King Solivar disappears too. So characters are just sort of blinking out of existence as the anti-Monitor wave is sort of sweeping over everything. But now it's time to go to a different time. We're headed to good old Coyote, Texas in the year 1879. And the world is certainly changing as all these DC Wild West characters they see this thing appear out of nowhere, that one of these other Monitor device things, these like giant towers, and they're just trying to figure out what the fuck is up with this thing. So I'm going to name some of these characters for you, Renzo. Here we have Johnny Thunder, who is an Old West speedster type. We have Nighthawk. Nighthawk, Batlash, and Jonah Hex. Why don't we hone in on that one, Remzo? What can you tell me about Jonah Hex?
Jonah Hex, originally a soldier in the Confederacy, realized that he didn't believe in the cause he was fighting for, so he teamed up with a Union platoon to go after the general he was serving under. During that time, he was almost gravely injured. It went ahead and deformed his face. He went ahead and basically helped the Union take over a town, which led to further victories in the Civil War, but no one ever trusted him because he had fought for the Confederacy. So they went ahead and not only basically said that, you're not getting a pardon, you're not a U.S. citizen, you're basically going to stay an outlaw, and yeah, you helped us, so we'll give you a day to go as fast as you could. So basically, he's a man of no country, he's a man of no allegiances. He went on to be a bounty hunter nonetheless, known throughout the Wild West as Johnny X.
And he is one ugly motherfucker, that's for sure. And so as they're trying to figure out what's up with this tower thing, another group of heroes slash villains appear to just kind of tell them what's going up. And they're like, it's basically Cyborg, John Stewart, Green Lantern, Firebrand, and Simon. And quite a hilarious line here from Jonah Hex, where he says, "Don't you remember the green costume on that hombre? It's the same one we saw on another guy who called himself a lantern or something. Only he wasn't no colored man."
Man, we've got Confederate ghost tanks and
hey, look, Jonah Hex is a man of his time, okay? And you know, and John Stewart takes this very well. He doesn't seem terribly offended. He's just like, "Sure am." And he says, "Sure am, sorry, ma'am. I'd never hurt no woman as..." Oh no, that, I'm sorry. That's still Jonah Hex talking. Or the other guy. There's a lot of cowboys here. John Stewart takes it pretty well. He just says like, "Oh yeah, I've replaced that other Green Lantern." He's like, they're like, "Okay, we just move on from this thing." And they're like, "Wait, if you're..." And this one guy's like, I don't know which one he is. I'm not even going to try to figure it out. He's like, "Wait, if you're not spirits, who are you?" And Firebrand's like, "Well, we're from another time, but we were brought here to save our world. Believe me, sometimes it makes a little sense to us too," which is just a nice little rib at the complexity of this whole thing. So as they're all trying to sort this out, you know who's going to show up again? It's those gosh darn shadow creatures. They show up yet again. So now this whole group of cowboys, Indians, Jonah Hex, bounty hunters, and a bunch of heroes and villains displaced from time and space are battling these shadow creatures. Amongst all of this, John Stewart notices that his power ring has ceased. His power ring has ceased to function. So maybe that has something to do with what we saw earlier with the Guardians, or maybe it didn't. It's hard to say, because there's a lot of shit going on here, my friends. Basically, in the end here, so just like with the other scenes here, as they're battling these creatures, everybody just starts to disappear, basically here. We then go back to Metropolis in the 30th century, and the Legion of Superheroes are kind of discussing what's going on. We have Dream Girl, and she's thinking to herself, "Well, I never did dream about this shit." I guess that's her thing. She dreams and like sees the future, but she never saw this thing coming. So, basically, once again, as we've seen elsewhere, things are just going white and people are disappearing. And then right as this issue wraps up here, we see these various Earths disappearing, or various time periods disappearing. Ancient Atlantis, the Old West, nothing is spared as the Monitor watches on and he laments to himself, instead of days, only hours remain. The Earths are doomed. Still, my machines are in place. My agents are at their posts. It's time for my plan to begin. And then we hear a voice off panel say, "Wrong, old fool. It's time for you to die." And it is Harbinger who has arrived to fulfill her destiny to kill the Monitor. Remzo, what do you think going into issue four here?
Some wild shit. Obviously, Harbinger is not really happy if this whole recruit all these losers things. So she's just going to go ahead and be like, you know, maybe we do need a restart.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So I'll let you take it away on issue four.
Issue four goes ahead and starts in Metropolis. What we see in our current time on Earth One is that all the power is going out. You see this giant white antimatter wave coming towards the city, and Supergirl is trying her hardest to try and make do with what she can with what little she knows, because she hasn't been recruited yet. She goes over to Barbara Gordon, Batgirl, on top of this rooftop, and Barbara Gordon's just like trying to figure out what's going on, but she feels helpless. And Supergirl's like, "Hurry, we have to do something." And Barbara's like, "Listen, girl, you can do what you want, but like, I don't have superpowers. I'm horrified. I'm literally useless right now." And Supergirl gives her a pep talk. She's like, "Barbara, look around you. There are firefighters, paramedics, cops, people who are trying to do what they can to maintain order and protect people. All the shit is going on. You're not nothing. You could do something, and something matters." Meanwhile, a plane in the sky is about to fall down, so Supergirl zips off in the sky to go take care of that. And there's our first introduction to Supergirl and Batgirl in this series. And as Batgirl is watching Supergirl fly off, she's like, she doesn't give a moment's thought to herself or her own safety. "Yeah, I know she cares if she lives or dies. She's a hero through and through. And while all I can think about is what will happen to me, my God, what have I become?" And that matters too, because Supergirl, who's had more of a presence recently in the DC Comics around this time, is also one of those characters who represents the heart of DC, the optimism, the hope of DC heroes. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. we're at East Hampton, the estate of Steve Dayton, the world's fifth richest man. He's got a friend over, and that friend is John Constantine, the Hellblazer. And Constantine, because he's a warlock, sorcerer, whatever you want to call him, he knows that something is happening, and he's just going to drink and smoke and let it happen, because this is obviously something far out of his control. So when you've got Constantine basically saying, "I've got nothing to do with this," yet you know it's bad. Meanwhile, Pariah shows back up on this other Earth, and what we see is that this other hero...
This guy's such a bummer. Always just shows up screaming about universe is dying.
Yeah, basically, he gets confronted by this guy who's the king of this planet named Lord Volt. And Lord Volt is like, "Stranger, my analyzers discovered your presence here on Earth. I am Lord Volt. Why do you attack us? What do you want from us?" And he's like, "No, I'm Pariah. I'm not the one you seek. I have nothing to do with this." Meanwhile...
And these are, once again, characters from not a DC multiverse. These are coming, I believe, from like an entirely different type of Earth.
Yeah, basically, Lord Volt has a family, the royal family. They all have superpowers. And long story short is they're trying to basically try and fight this wave, this I want to call it the annihilation wave, it's something different, this antimatter wave. What they realize is that they're powerless. So literally, the entire royal family is watching all their siblings, sisters, brothers, everyone is dying, and then eventually this earth just gets destroyed. It's just another excuse to show that that something is
just an excuse to kill more characters. Because yeah. Lord Volt dies, and then I think Lady Quark somehow gets spared.
Lady Quark gets pulled by this guy named Lord Karak, and he has the ability to jump between universes and time, so he saves her before they are the last ones to get destroyed. She's like, "No, leave me be. Let me die with my family. Please, please don't." And he's like, "I'm so sorry, but I have to. You can't die. If I can save but my own life, my eternal damnation will be eased much more." So basically, they shoot off to somewhere before that Earth gets annihilated, basically. Meanwhile, we're back at the Monitor's lab.
And this must take place. I mean, this whole series is not necessarily in chronological order because we're dealing with different time periods, but suddenly the Monitor's fine. So I guess like they showed us what's going to happen, but now they're going back and showing us what happened.
I'm going to skip the next part with a Judo Master, I think, because it really doesn't matter. Basically see a bunch of these scientists in Japan and they're witnessing other planets just completely disappear. And that's a thing. Meanwhile, we go back to,
well, the important part of this is that this one scientist's daughter disappears. Her name is Kimio and she will return later in another form.
But basically we go back to the anti-monitors place. I know that is correct. And what ends up happening is the anti-matter is basically looking around and he sees the red tornado basically disappear and everyone's disappearing. And at this point, Psycho Pirate is just like, you know, these people are just going to die. Why are you grabbing them? So basically the anti-monitor is recruiting his own people, thinking that he could go ahead and recruit them to also fight the monitor who's trying to stop the anti-monitor. And, you know, at this point, even though he's a robot, Red Tornado is still a hero. And he's just like, what the hell am I doing here? So he's like, what are you doing to my Earth? And the anti-monitor is just like, more than just your Earth, android. Now come, we have a universe to destroy. Meanwhile, Killer Frost and Sir Justin, one of the Knights of the Round Table, and Firestar are now...
I just love how Firestorm is so just constantly annoyed by Killer Frost being in love with him. He's like, God damn it. Why did Psycho Pirate make her fall in love with me and just take off? Yeah. Like, now I got to deal with this chick the whole time.
You know, Vandal Savage is there, the immortal caveman, the immortal man. And he's just witnessing all this. And he's just like, this is obviously like, I'm evil and stuff. But I've got nothing to do here. So I'm just going to watch all this shit happen. Meanwhile, we see this giant black creature come up near that giant tower where Alexander Luther was found. And he's just like, he's like all the shadow creatures combined, and he destroys the tower. Meanwhile, you've got all the Western heroes and Cyborg and his crew watching this, and they're just horrified. Oh, yeah. And this is when Kimiko, the new Dr. Light, suddenly appears, and she is there to basically be the foil to the anti-monitor, because while he's all darkness, she is the new Dr. Light. And that's why she was zapped out of her lab on her Earth. So now all the heroes are here. They're fighting the anti-monitor, and they've actually gotten to the point where they're like, oh my gosh, we could actually like fight this. But the monitor is just like, you know, maybe we're too late. We don't know, because he's already destroyed so many Earths. He's so powerful. Meanwhile, we get back to the end of issue 3, where Harbinger jumps in. And at this point, she's attacking the monitor, because she's just like, I'm done with this. You raised me to do all this, but I don't believe in it anymore. You're freaking dead. So she basically, from what we can tell, she kills the monitor. But at this point, the anti-monitor is still killing Earths. And at this point, Pariah jumps in, and he's just like, if the monitor's not here, what the hell are we gonna do?
I like how he's just like, what the fuck has happened? Like, he just showed up here, and then this other chick shows up and kills the guy that brought him there. So he's like,
at this point, Pariah can tell what's happening, because we get 2 pages of just screaming but no words, and all the heroes and all the Earths and all the timelines looking up. And what they basically see is that all these planets, all these multiverses, are colliding and falling into this white nothingness. And in the last page, it's just smoke and nothing. And it's one of those areas where it's like, you let the art speak for itself. The art is speaking for itself. And that is the,
not a word of dialogue in the last almost 3 pages.
The end of issue 4.
Yeah. And this, again, I say reminiscent, but this came first of an Infinity War, when Thanos first snapped everything out, and you see just heroes disappear, and you're like, whoa, shit, I guess they're all gone. And then, you know, so this kind of leaves us on another cliffhanger, only 4 issues in, and we've apparently seen the multiverse die. So it's a fitting way to end, I think, the first episode of our Crisis Month. Again, that will be this and the next 2 episodes of this podcast. But I guess we're going to hold off our official grades till the whole thing's over, so we can just kind of give our general thoughts. But I'll just say, you know, I think we put this off for a long time because it's big. There's a lot to it, and we didn't want to gloss over it, so we wanted to make sure we kind of cordoned off the proper time for it. But for a dense story with a lot of characters, when you take it all into context, it actually flies by pretty quickly. And it's, even though it's complicated, it's not that hard to keep track of. Actually, I remember thinking it was more complicated, and it is complicated in the sense there's many characters, there's many different universes. But considering all that,
it's kind of easy to follow. They show you what's going on. They you know, the monitor is basically your universal narrator. You have these other characters that we learn everything that's happening through the characters. So that's like the purpose of Pariah. It's the purpose of Monitor. And it's just setting us up for, it seems like this is the event already, but it's really just setting us up for the next 8 issues to come when, you know, the real story is about to really kick in.
Yeah. I mean, just so much has happened here. And each time I read this, I just read something or I see something and it connects to something else later, earlier in the series. But I mean, like Ghost Tank, I swear to God, Mark, I've read this thing twice, and this is the first time I've noticed Ghost Tank.
I barely even noticed the first time. Yeah. But man, we're gonna have to rank all the characters at the end of this. And Ghost Tank is gonna be in the conversation. That's all I know.
Easily. He's in it for like two panels, but Ghost Tank is there.
So no grades for these, but if you want to hear the next two parts of this crisis month before everyone else, you should support us on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/secondprintpod. We pour our hearts and souls into this podcast, into creating this community for you guys, where you can get a break from all the nonsense going on in the world today and just hang out with us and talk about comics. And we have an absolute blast doing it. And we have even more fun in the Patreon and the Second Print Comics Fan Zone, our Facebook group for patrons only. Have some great conversations there. And there's just so much fun for patrons. Why don't you tell them all about it, Renzo?
Well, folks, we've got exclusive shows. We have Claire Continues, where Mark covers all the stories galore during his dark
I'm just going to say I have not done that in about 6 months, so I'm just going to call it the defunct Claire Continues. I've moved on to other projects now.
I'm sorry. It's What Mark Missed. You see, folks, we've got so many spinoffs.
We can't even keep track.
Yeah, we recently released a potpourri episode. You can go ahead and tune into that right now. I'm going to the post office when I return back to Wisconsin. I'm sending out some hardcover graphic novels to our $25 patrons at the Epic Crossover level. A few weeks ago, we went ahead and did our SPC Villains episode, which is an idea from our friend Eric, who's at the Kirby Club level of $50 a month, where you get everything prior, the calls, the graphic novels, the bonus shows and stuff, but you actually get to produce an episode.
And we will have another Kirby Club episode later this month from our newest Kirby Club member, Jeffrey.
What did he want to do? Let's spoil that a bit.
We may as well promote it since we already know we're going to be continuing with the Max. So we did the first, I think, 4 issues of the Max very early on in this podcast. And he wants us to do basically the next volume.
Yeah. So if you want to produce an episode of the show, tell Mark and I what to cover. You can go ahead and join us at that Kirby Club level. All that and more, all the fun and galore at patreon.com/secondprintpod.
Indeedy, indeedy. And that's going to wrap it for this. The first of 3 issues looking at Crisis on Infinite Earths. It's a big month here in December for us here at SBC, so we hope you enjoy the ride as much as we do. And until next time, we just have one final parting request, and that is to read comics
and change
the world.
Good night, America.
Adios.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.